This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Down-ballot races in North Carolina don't always conjure up the same level of attention as higher-profile battles. But this year, the race for a seat on North Carolina's Supreme Court may also carry an important ideological shift. Justice Bob Edmunds is a registered Republican. He's fighting to keep his spot on the North Carolina Supreme Court, and with it, a 4-3 Republican majority on the court. Edmunds is running against Wake County Superior Court Judge Mike Morgan. He's a registered Democrat, and he will be joining us on Thursday. But today I'm honored to be able to talk with Justice Bob Edmunds in the studio. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Well, thank you, Frank. I appreciate the invitation.
Your opponent, Judge Morgan, says that he's concerned that the court is becoming more politicized. We talked about this kind of ideological split of 4-3 Republican or conservative majority. Should we be concerned about that?
Well, I have to take issue with that premise. I don't think so. The court has handled a number of cases this year, for instance. I'm not sure the exact number, but here it is, late mid-October. Of all the cases that we've issued this year, only three were not unanimous. I can't tell you what all three of them were, but one of them involved an indictment issue, which is not terribly political. We had a dissent on that one. And we had another one where I joined a dissent with two other judges in, or justices in the other party. This is not a court that's really at each other's throats. For the most part, we work together and do things. A case that we had recently that some would say was political is the Kolash Commission, where the governor and the General Assembly were at odds over who could make appointments to that one. That was a 7-0 unanimous decision.
Well, now let's take a look at that one. I mean, there you have two Republican basically participants or opponents in the case, so it's hard to know where the ideological split. That's more of a balance of power question, checks and balances. But where there is unanimity tend to be in criminal and civil cases. There have been some fairly high-profile political cases where the ideological split was precisely the vote, the 4-3, for instance, on redistricting, which this—
Well, everybody turns to that one particular case. And in fact, we did split. But I mean, one fact of life is courts find themselves handling political cases or cases that have a political component sometime. And those who disagree with the court's result will sometimes say, well, the judges were acting for political reasons. I mean, if that's the only lens you're looking through, that might be the way you see it. But I have to look at one case out of the great many that we have tried. And whenever I get asked this question, which is almost every interview I get, that is the case that's brought up.
Well, the other one is vouchers, and that was
that's the other one that tends to be
well,
brought up.
Well, there we go, and there's a very important ideological split supporting the state, the legislature, and the governor on whether or not this state should be able to use public money to support private education, 4-3 split.
Well, the question that comes before us is not, is this a good idea? The question before us is whether or not it's constitutional. And I expect we'll see further litigation on the school voucher cases as it matures. But we were not called upon to address the question of whether or not it was a good law or, a wise law, let me say. The question was, does the Constitution allow it? And the majority believed that the Constitution did allow it.
Well, let me stick with redistricting for a bit. Again, a 4-3 split, again, along party lines in the state Supreme Court. So there's a split on the question of whether or not race was improperly used to develop voting districts in the state of North Carolina. A federal appeals court didn't split at all. They saw in no uncertain terms that race was the determining factor and it was improper, and it was not at all a question for them.
Well, I mean, excuse me while I'm trying to make sure I explain this as best I can. But during the time I've been on the Supreme Court, we've had a number of redistricting cases, and the most recent one before this was a 2006 case I wrote or an opinion I wrote for the court involving Pender County and the North Carolina Constitution. Now, when we deal with these cases, redistricting cases, Frank, we just got a ton of things to deal with. The 14th Amendment requires that race not be considered. People get equal protection regardless of race. On the other hand, the Voting Rights Act requires consideration of race. The North Carolina is partially covered by the Voting Rights Act. the North Carolina General, not the General Assembly, the North Carolina Constitution has the whole county provision that's still in effect, where it's not inconsistent with the Voting Rights Act. And we have all the old, we have one person, one vote, Reynolds versus Sims. Then we've got all some older factors that we have to consider, like contiguity of the districts. Incumbent protection is allowed. So trying to, you know, in the Pender County case, I was dealing with all those factors and wrote an opinion that went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which affirmed it. The case you're talking about, the more recent one, we call it the Rucho case because he was one of the named parties. My analytical framework was pretty much the same. It's just a question of, I mean, you're talking about this is went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and that's where the changes had taken place. There were different personnel on that court, and they did find they found error in that case. Now, the one you're talking about, I believe, that went to the Fourth Circuit, that was through the federal courts, not through us.
Right, but I mean, it was the same law that they were looking at, that you were looking at, and they found, in no uncertain terms, that race was improperly used. So again, but let's come back to this business of how these races are won. The U.S. Supreme Court, rather surprisingly, Justice Roberts wrote the decision affirming a state's right to, in fact, take money out of judicial races to preclude judges from soliciting campaign funds. This came as a surprise from the author of the law that allowed unlimited money to go into political campaigns, not judicial. How do you feel about that? Should we not be running these campaigns, and should judges not be allowed to solicit campaign funds, given the what the judiciary what we expect from the judiciary?
I think in an ideal world, that would be a good idea, Frank. I was at a judicial forum last week at the University, Charlotte School of Law, and the question was, would the most of the judicial candidates for the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals were there, and the question was, would you like public financing? And every single one of us said yes. I've run in both races. I've run in races both where there was public financing, my first couple of races, and this year too, and in races where we've had public financing. Did I get that right? I've both types of races.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are advantages and disadvantages to each. There's a lot to be said for public financing because the candidates know up front how much they've got to deal with. And, I mean, you've hit it when you say it's awkward at best for judges to be directly soliciting funds. On the other hand, you know, judges don't make these decisions how these races are to be structured. That's a question for the General Assembly. And we can only, you know, work within the rules they give us. So, you know, I would be perfectly happy if we went back to public financing, but, you know, that's not what we've got right now.
Well, and again, to look at the way politics is now a part of our judicial system, the General Assembly passed a law earlier this year that would have created a retention election, which would have affected you in your seat this year. And that means that you wouldn't have to run for re-election against an opponent, only it would essentially be a referendum, should you be retained. Now, that's an advantage for an incumbent. You would be the direct beneficiary this year. The North Carolina legislature, dominated by Republicans, passed that law. In fact, it was overturned by a court, a lower court, ultimately. It would have come to your court. You recused yourself when it did. There was a 3-3 tie, and therefore the lower court decision obtained, and therefore it's not a law. But I'm saying to the observer, to the outside observer, it's very clear what the North Carolina legislature was trying to do. They wanted to retain their majority, not necessarily you personally, but they needed to retain their majority. How do I, as a citizen, feel comfortable that this system is really working fairly for me?
Well, first of all, let me say this was passed not this year, though it was reversed this year. I had nothing to do with it. The General Assembly did not ask me about it. I didn't go to them to have anything to do with it. It came as a surprise to me, just as to everybody else. But I think what you're overlooking is the fact that the process of getting to a retention election is one that's been going on for a number of years. The North Carolina Bar Association was a strong proponent of it, as were a number of advocacy groups. So when it finally came up to the General Assembly, it was something that was had wide support. And to say that it was done, you know, for the partisan reasons you claim, I think certainly at least oversimplifies what was going on. As a member of the Bar Association, having been an officer in it, I think it was something that was a priority for the Bar Association.
What would be the advantages of it?
Well, it gets us out of the process of fundraising, which you just went into. Mm-hmm. It allows judges, for instance, during the time that bill was in effect, of course, I continued campaigning, but instead of going out and saying, I'm the best candidate, I went out and was essentially giving civics lectures and talking to public groups like Rotary Clubs, Kiwanis Clubs, those sort of organizations where the membership, they're not partisan, they're just interested in the body politic and how it works, explaining what was going on, why the bill was there, how it had been changed, what it meant to them, what the ballot was going to look like. That was, I've got to tell you, I certainly enjoyed that part of it because I got to go across the state and, you know, deal with, you know, sort of the fun legal issues. But that didn't last, so that's back where we are. But, you know, to get back to your question, that's one of the advantages. It allows judges to indulge in both the education process and to get feedback at the same time.
So what does, let's talk about that now, what does qualify you to be a justice on the Supreme Court? Why should we vote for you?
Well, the main thing, Frank, is I've been doing it for 16 years. I have a record. Everything I've written for the court is out in the public. Now, I know most folks, for some reason, don't read all that stuff. But I think one thing, one strong, valid proxy for whether I'm not a, you know, candidates will talk about themselves and say nice things. But look at who's supporting me. I've been endorsed by four former chief justices of the court, two Republicans and two Democrats. Who better knows who does the work? I list my supporters on, my endorsers, there's a difference, on my website. And it's most of the former presidents of the North Carolina State Bar and the North Carolina Bar Association. More than 90% of North Carolina sheriffs. These cover the political waterfront. I'm the only candidate with bipartisan support. And if you look outside the state, I was back in August, I was named chair-elect of the American Bar Association's Appellate Judges Division section. That's over 1,100 state and federal appellate judges and attorneys. I told them, hey, I got an election. Anything could happen. They said, we know your work. We want you on being our leader. So I think the people who are directly affected by my work, the lawyers, the law enforcement officials who know what's going on, they see that I'm not a politically driven person, that my record and my experience shows I can and do a good job.
Well, let's talk about that experience. What outside of the courtroom and your job as a state Supreme Court justice have you done that you think bears on your job today and qualifies you?
The main thing I would focus on there is the fact I've been in private practice. I'm the only candidate who's actually done that in this race. For a number of years, I was with a firm in Greensboro. During that time, I did mostly criminal work, enough civil work so I could pass a lie detector test, but it was mostly criminal. But during that time, I learned, if you don't perform, you don't get paid. If you don't get paid, you can't pay your staff. I know what it's like to deal with, difficult opposing counsel. I know what it's like to deal with clients who aren't particularly happy with you. I know what it's like to deal with judges who are having a bad day, and that informs the work I do, how I treat the people who are in front of me. It was, in some ways, it was a demanding time. It had a great many satisfactions. But during that time, I was board certified as a specialist in state and federal criminal law. And you only get board certification by showing substantial involvement in the field, undergoing an examination, and getting peer review. The next year, I was named as a board-certified specialist in appellate practice. I'm the only one that's got a piece of paper that says I'm an expert in this field.
You've been on the Supreme Court since 2001. We've talked about a number of cases that your critics point to and are considered controversial. What are some of the cases that you like to highlight in your work that you've done in 16 years?
One that's pretty recent that I expect most folks who are listening will be familiar with was the teacher tenure case. I mean, tenure is not exactly what was going on, but that was in North Carolina. Public teachers can earn career teacher status, and it gives them a degree of job security and some pay benefits. the General Assembly tried, in a money-saving measure, tried to change it, so taking away career status and giving other, not quite comparable, incentives to teachers. I wrote the opinion for the court that said, no, you can't do that. These men and women have already earned their career status. They get to keep it. And we founded it on the Contracts Clause of the North Carolina Constitution. So that was both fun to write, and there was a very strong sense among us that it was the right result.
There are some critics who take a look at your workload over the past several years and say that, in fact, the state Supreme Court just is not deciding enough cases. There's been a decline in the number of cases you decide.
There has been a decline, and we're aware of that, and under Chief Justice Martin, we're trying to fix it. But a number of factors sort of came into play. Far fewer death penalty cases, which come directly to us, than when I joined the court in 2000. We heard our first death penalty case all year earlier this month. The financial crisis back in 2008 had a real factor because it costs money to appeal cases. It can cost tens of thousands of dollars. And people will sometimes say, no, I'm not going to get, I could get this to the Supreme Court, but I'm not going to. The other factor that's mediation between the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. A lot of cases are, sort of intercepted there. We also have to leave some flex just because we don't know how many cases that we're going to have to take will be coming our way. I mean, those are factors. And the fact is we have a supervisory responsibility. The numbers are down, and we're aware that we need to get them up. We're getting them up, but it's not an immediate process.
There was a controversial bill. Again, this is the legislature passing this bill, but it gives the state Supreme Court justices authority to discipline judges, including themselves. They would have the right to discipline behind closed doors. It doesn't come to light. How do you feel about that?
It hasn't come up very often. We don't see many of those cases, fortunately, because we don't like to see judges getting disciplined. Again, it was the General Assembly's call. In some ways, I would like to see as open a process as possible. Most of the cases that we have dealt with in the time I've been on the court dealing with open records have been in favor of openness and availability. So, I don't have enough experience on the ground that there just aren't that many cases.
Well, but I mean, the one that comes, the one that we hear is the one that we want adjudicated, and we'd like to know that you're not, adjudicating your own case, right, or a fellow judge down the line.
Well, we wouldn't be adjudicating our own. They would go to the Court of Appeals, as I understand the law.
Well, I don't know. I think we've gotten guidance on this that suggests that the ultimate authority would be the state Supreme Court, even if it was a state Supreme Court justice. But I think that's our understanding of this.
Well, I'm not going to disagree with you, Frank. I'm not. Fortunately, we haven't had any of our members.
Well, let's do just the brief civics 101. What kind of cases do you hear? We've come to the end. We've got maybe about 45 seconds left. But what does the state Supreme Court, what kind of cases do you hear?
Come from a number of sources. There's some we have to take, like the capital cases I mentioned, business court cases. If the Court of Appeals, which sits in panels of three, if the three can't agree and one judge writes a dissent, then we have to take it if the parties want to bring it to us. And we have discretionary authority to pick cases that meet certain statutory requirements. Effectively, they have to be pretty important cases that have an impact on the jurisdiction. They're the ones we like because they're the ones we have a choice in. The other ones are coming to us whether we want them or not.
Justice Bob Edmonds is running to keep North Carolina Supreme Court Justice seat in an upcoming election. His opponent, Judge Mike Morgan, will join us on this show this coming Thursday. And if you are a resident of North Carolina, remember early voting starts Thursday. Bob Edmonds, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Frank.
Just ahead, photographer Sheila Prebright joins us to talk about her exploration of social movements and race, particularly in the South. Do stay with us.